A lot of the people that were in the minority are now in the majority this year, and it's all about retaliation.
Alaska Democrats face a new era of legislative partisanship. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska senators make the case for labels on GMO salmon.
If their fish product is so good, then tell us what it is. That's all we're asking.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
When the bipartisan coalition lost control of the state Senate in 2012, it was a given that its Democratic members would see a big drop in the number of bills they got through. But that loss of clout also affected Democrats in the House. With the legislature adjourned and a pile of bills awaiting the governor's signature, APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez looks at how power shifted in this legislature.
Representative Chris Tuck sponsored about a dozen bills this past legislative cycle. Only a couple of those items ever got hearings, and just one, a bill dealing with craft distilleries, actually passed. As far as Democrats go, Tuck considers himself one of the lucky ones.
I hope it'd be like 4-1, but unfortunately, we feel blessed to even have a bill pass.
Tuck is used to it. Democrats have been the minority party in the state House ever since the 90s, and their caucus only occupies 10 of the House's 40 seats right now. For the past few legislatures, the House minority would get one bill passed per member, if you average it out. That's only a small fraction of the legislation that gets passed, but it was something. This legislature, that number dropped. Instead of one bill a person, it's now about half a bill. If you were a member of the majority this legislature, you were six times more likely to get a bill through. So what changed? While the composition of the House did not shift much in the last election, the makeup of the Senate did.
It does have effect that bleeds over to the House.
Instead of having a Republican House working with a team of Democrats and moderate Republicans in the Senate, the legislature effectively switched to one-party government with the last election. Tuck thinks that means minority members are less likely to have ownership over some of their policies, even if they introduced them first. For example, a bill requiring babies to be screened for heart defects was originally introduced by a House Democrat, but the version that passed was offered by a Senate Republican.
It's not about the policy as much as it is who gets credit.
There are a few possible reasons for this. If a bill does not have your name on it, it's harder to campaign on it as a legislative accomplishment. It's also easier to get a minority bill through one adversarial chamber than it is to get it through two of them. If a Democratic bill made it through the House during the bipartisan coalition days, then there was probably a sympathetic ear for it in the Senate. These days, not so much, says Tuck.
A lot of the people that were in the minority in the 27th Alaska legislature are now in the majority this year, and it's all about retaliation in some form.
In total, the House minority got six bills passed this legislature, and the Senate minority got zero. That's out of nearly 200 bills. In a lot of ways, that's just the way the game is played. Wasilla Republican Charlie Huggins currently serves as the Senate president, but before the 2012 election, he was part of the Senate's small conservative minority caucus.
Obviously, in the minority, you get to do a lot of observing, maybe grit your teeth every once in a while.
Under the bipartisan coalition's leadership, the Senate minority fared a little better than the current Democratic minority, but not by much. Instead of getting zero bills through, they managed to pass anywhere from one to three bills per legislature. On the rare occasions they were able to get their bills through the more Democratic Senate, those measures sailed through just fine in the Republican-led House. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A U.S. Senate panel today moved to require labeling for genetically modified salmon if it's approved for sale in this country. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the labeling mandate is now part of an agriculture appropriations bill pending in the Senate.
Senator Lisa Murkowski told the Appropriations Committee she hopes the FDA never allows genetically modified salmon to reach supermarket shelves.
But we haven't been able to get the FDA to slow down off their track of approval.
So Murkowski says they should at least require the product to carry labels.
That they put on the package of fish, it says, this is a genetically engineered salmon.
But mandatory labeling repels senators from farm states who fear it'll lead to labeling of GM crops. Senator Mike Johanns of Nebraska defended genetically modified food at the hearing, saying it can help sustain the world's ever-growing population. Johanns says labeling would be a compliance nightmare, with consumers footing the bill.
There's a cost to that for no basis in science.
The company that wants to produce the Aqua Advantage salmon says its farmed fish would be just like conventional Atlantic salmon. Senator Mark Begich, who co-sponsored Murkowski's labeling amendment, says the company should just be upfront with consumers.
If their fish product is so good, then tell us what it is. That's all we're asking.
Appropriations Committee Chairwoman Barbara Mikulski called for the vote.
In favor of the Murkowski Begich amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed signify by saying no.
No.
The ayes do have it. The
Alaska's delegation to Congress has fought to require labeling in years past, only to see it stripped out of the final legislation. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The Funny River fire that has been burning on the Kenai Peninsula since Monday has grown to nearly 50,000 acres. Dan Nelson is the health and safety officer for Central Emergency Services out of Soldotna. He says the fire is about 5% contained.
What you're seeing today, a little shift in action from, you know, more of a, you know, trying to, you know, game plan and get priorities set and figure out what's going on to an actual going out there and attacking the fire. We have over 150 people on the ground and numerous aircraft out there. So the priorities have not changed. The priorities are still keep the fire away from the Funny River Road community and from the Kisilov community.
Fire crews from across the state had set up a communication center at Skyview High School in Soldotna. The fire is still not an immediate threat to life or property. Community meetings were held last night for people closest to the fire. No evacuation orders have been given as the fire continues to spread into the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. On the western side of Cook Inlet, the Tionic Fire has grown to more than 1,800 acres. Most of the recent activity has been on the north end of the fire. Pete Buist is a fire information officer with the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center. He says crews are conducting burnout operations around power lines and oil and gas infrastructure near Beluga.
It means that those crews got in around some of the infrastructure there and started little fires on their own, burning out towards the main fire, so that if the main fire was to get there, it would have less fuel up close to those things that they want to protect.
There are 108 firefighters working on the Tionic Fire. No evacuation orders are in effect for Beluga or Tionic. A thick haze of smoke covered Anchorage and much of the Matanuska-Susitna borough this morning. The smoke from both the Tionic and Funny River wildfires was heavy over Anchorage in the early hours, although a light breeze helped to push the smoke away by afternoon. But Christian Cassell with the National Weather Service's Anchorage office says winds now helping to clear smoke away from the city are about to change.
The next 24 hours or so through, let's say, tomorrow afternoon, we're looking pretty good with north winds that'll gust 20 to 25 miles per hour or so. So we're looking at the smoke being pushed off to the south of Anchorage. As we get into tomorrow, however, the wind's going to start reversing again, and it's going to start coming out of the south. And that's going to start pushing the smoke up towards Anchorage Way again. And unfortunately, it looks like we're going to be in that pattern through the weekend.
Cassell says the worst smoke conditions are generally in the late night and earliest morning hours because of an inversion created when the ground cools faster than the air above it.
So it kind of creates this stable layer just above the surface, and unfortunately that traps all the smoke. And then if you get a wind that's coming under that inversion, and that'll just allow the smoke to just spread out. So last night that's what it did. It spread the smoke from the fire underneath that inversion, and it just brought it right up into Anchorage, and there was no way to mix that air out.
When the sun comes up and the wind changes direction, the inversion is disturbed, allowing the smoke to move out. Health officials warn those sensitive to air pollution, children, and the elderly should remain indoors during air quality alerts. The Matanuska-Susitna Borough has issued a borough-wide air quality alert effective today until the smoke clears. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, UAF tries to trim millions of dollars from the budget.
You have roughly flat tuition revenue, you have the federal research environment is very tight, and you have rising personnel costs.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Representative Don Young has introduced a resolution that would help clear the way for a deepwater port outside of Nome. House Resolution 4668 would divide about 2,500 acres of federal land among the Coast Guard, State of Alaska, and the Bering Straits Native Association. The idea, Young says, is to hasten infrastructure development by creating a public-private partnership in the area of Port Clarence, where the Army Corps of Engineers has identified the potential site, including former Coast Guard facilities at Point Spencer.
The Coast Guard has no money. The Corps has identified this one area, and it's a public-private participation. So any facility should be, very frankly, financed by private with the public input.
Under the resolution, the Native Corporation would take over the vast majority of the land. Corporation Resources head Matt Ganley said they've been discussing the Point Spencer lands with Congressman Young and his staff since 2010, when the Coast Guard decommissioned its facilities in the area, and fully support Young's legislation. The acreage that the Coast Guard and the state would receive are comparatively small, but vital for infrastructure development. Young says freeing up land the federal government has failed to so far take advantage of is the first step toward building vital infrastructure.
This has been identified as one of the more likely areas by the Coast Guard and the Corps of Engineers. I'm not going to pick the areas. I'm just trying to provide the areas necessary to have a deep water port to be needed badly up there because of the Arctic participation. And this is the first step.
In his email, Ganley wrote that during a meeting last February, residents and leadership in Brevik, Mission, and Teller supported the prospect of jobs and economic opportunity nearby development could bring, but also raised concerns about the effects to subsistence resources. Though the resolution has a special provision recognizing archaeological and cultural heritage in the region, there is no mention of subsistence anywhere in it. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is scheduled to release a report with recommendations for an Arctic deep draft port in the region by the end of the summer. There's not yet a timeline for how Young's resolution will advance in the House. Congress has passed a $12 billion water resources bill that may help Alaska gain a deepwater Arctic port, although it doesn't actually fund one. The provision, supported by the entire Alaska congressional delegation, would allow the Corps of Engineers to provide technical assistance to local or tribal governments who want to develop an Arctic port and accept money from them. For other harbors around Alaska, the bill allows the Corps to consider subsistence use, not just economic development, when selecting projects to fund. The Water Resources Reform and Development Act authorizes more than 30 major projects in the lower 48, such as harbor dredging and flood control work. It now goes to President Barack Obama for his signature. Money and drugs went missing from the evidence room at the police station in Barrow last year, and now the North Slope Borough is launching an investigation into what happened. KNOM's Matthew Smith reports.
A North Slope Borough Police Department memo written by an evidence custodian in February of 2013 details missing cash and cocaine from the department's evidence safe. Barrow Police Officer Gary Moore gave the memo to the Arctic Sounder online newspaper in March of this year. The memo was obtained by KNOM this week. The memo says twice in February 2013, the custodian found evidence tags attached to empty bags or attached to nothing at all. A bag meant to be filled with confiscated cocaine was found to be cut open and emptied. Several other envelopes filled with cash had also been opened and emptied, and one envelope tagged as containing more than $4,000 in cash had disappeared completely. In all, just under $5,400 and an unknown amount of cocaine is missing, affecting as many as 7 separate cases within the North Slope Borough Police Department. Borough Mayor Charlotte Brower and other borough employees refused to comment on the matter Thursday. Borough Attorney Lauren Bordeaux said in an emailed statement the North Slope Borough has hired an independent consultant to, quote, aggressively conduct an investigation into, quote, all allegations that question the proper and ethical practices of the Borough Police Department. The borough's inquiry comes amid a visit from the FBI earlier this month. FBI spokesperson Kevin Donovan wouldn't say if the visit was related to the missing evidence.
I can confirm that we had one agent from the FBI meeting with members of the North Slope Borough Police Department. During the week of May 5th, we had one agent there. The nature of that visit is not something we're disclosing.
An employee at the police department who didn't want to be identified spoke with the FBI agent at the time of their visit and said the agent plans to return in the future to administer polygraph tests. The FBI visit and the borough's investigation come on the heels of the announcement that North Slope Police Chief Leon Boyer is stepping down on July 1st. In an email sent April 17th announcing his retirement, Boyer says he's stepping down due to family needs. Chief Boyer and North Slope Police Captain Daryl Holman did not return messages Thursday. Several members of the Borough Assembly say they have yet to hear anything about the investigation from the mayor's office. In Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks committee is recommending cuts to close an expected $12 to $14 million FY15 budget deficit. The Planning and Budget Committee was charged with developing options to address rising costs and decreased state funding. The Planning and Budget Committee proposals encompass across-the-board and targeted reductions, including the potential loss of about 100 jobs. UAF Vice Chancellor for Administrative Services Pat Pitney says the university is responding to a legislatively imposed 5% personnel cut at all University of Alaska campuses, a reduction, she says, is compounded by other factors.
There's continued pressure to keep the tuition rate down. So you have roughly flat tuition revenue. You have the federal research environment is very tight. And you have rising personnel costs, rising energy costs. You have kind of a double whammy when you're not just getting cut from the state, but you have other revenue constraints as well.
The numerous top tier of recommendations of the Planning and Budget Committee include cutting the number of senior level executives, administrators, and management staff, going to 11-month contracts, extending winter break and other campus closures, consolidating or eliminating low enrollment programs, reducing shuttle bus service, offering more degree programs online, reducing staff travel, and upgrading buildings to make them more energy efficient. A lower tier of possible actions titled Recommendations with Reservations include elimination of university funding for KUAC public radio and TV. Pitney says the committee prioritized its recommended cuts, but Chancellor Brian Rogers and cabinet members have leeway to decide what to implement, noting there are benefits to targeted cuts.
To the degree that we can pick a particular service or program to eliminate, that reduces the amount of pain every department has to take.
Pitney says the UAF board budget reduction proposals are open to public comment, including at a June Board of Regents meeting. After that, she says, Chancellor Rogers and cabinet members will have to decide which cuts to implement in time for the university to finalize a budget before July 1st.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. Finding the time for physical activity after school, homework, and dinner can be tough, but you can make it a priority to stay healthy as a family. Go for a bike ride, take a walk around the neighborhood, or play a game of basketball with your kids. Get active, get moving, and have fun as a family. Inspire your kids to get out and play 60 minutes every day. For more ways to get physically active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska has a new president. Jim Grasco is replacing Jeff Davis, who held the job for 17 years and is retiring at the end of June. Premera Alaska is the largest health insurer in the state, serving more than 100,000 customers. Davis lived in Anchorage and was actively engaged in healthcare issues in the community, serving on several boards. Grasco will be based in Seattle, and the company says he isn't likely to have the same public presence in the state as Davis. Eric Erling is vice president of corporate communications for Premera. He says Grasco will travel to Alaska frequently, and if anything, he expects an increased focus on the market in the state.
Yeah, I wouldn't put the expectation that because there's a change in one position, that results in a substantive impact in how we serve the market as a whole. In fact, I think a number of members of our team are going to be collectively more active in Alaska than they may have been in the past, just because of some things we want to do to serve the market better, regardless of who holds the title of president of Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska.
Erling says the biggest issue Grasco will face is the rising cost of medical care in Alaska and the impact that has on health care coverage. Grasco has been with Premera since 1999 and was previously the vice president for underwriting at the company. Lon Wilson is president and CEO of the Wilson Agency, a brokerage firm that works closely with Premera. Wilson says he knows both Davis and Grasco, and he thinks the change is a positive one.
We're losing somebody in Jeff Davis that's spent many, many years here in Alaska and knew the market very, very well. We're also gaining somebody that has been with Premera for 15 plus years and knows the company very well and has led the underwriting department for many years and is very knowledgeable about the business in Alaska, even though he hasn't physically been here.
Premera has about 40 employees in Alaska. The company doesn't expect to make any other changes in the Alaska office. The YK Delta's first skilled nursing facility is open and just received the federal certification necessary for payment from Medicare and Medicaid. The certification comes just as the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, which runs the elders home, faces an $11.7 million budget shortfall. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
Today, the staff of the Elders Home in Bethel is celebrating their recent certification with a party. YKHC CEO Dan Winkelman steps from the celebration and into the airy entryway of the new building, which is decorated with a mural depicting the seasons.
You'll see a seal hunter with his catch there and his kayak, and then you'll see a berry picker as you go in a clockwise direction. And she's picking salmon berries, and then you'll see some swans flying across.
The nursing home, which looks more like a fishing lodge from the outside, is a project of YKHC that's been planned for decades to give elders in the Delta care closer to home. YKHC is grappling with an $11.7 million budget shortfall due to revenue collection issues and sequester cuts to Indian Health Service funding. Winkelman says YKHC has been picking up $2 million in operating costs since the home opened in October because it lacked certification. The home attempted certification twice. In October, there were 17 deficiencies and 5 in December when they tried again. The home finally passed federal certification in April, allowing Medicare and Medicaid billing. Gerald Hodges manages the elder's home. He leads me from the entry into a hallway that separates two wings, past a chapel and therapy room with exercise equipment, and into a common area.
As we go here then to the right, in this side here, we have a total of 8 rooms. We also have right in front of us here as you first come in is an area we call our native kitchen. And we have a stove with a commercial hood, microwave, refrigerators, a freezer, dishwasher, and a sink. And it's designed so that family members can come up and prepare food for their elders.
Elders recline in cushy chairs watching a DVD of Chiang Mai Dance Festival on a large screen TV. Signs around the building are in English and Yupik, and several of the staff speak Yupik. The idea, Hodges says, is to improve quality of life for the aging population of the YK Delta region by allowing them to stay closer to home to receive culturally relevant care. The closest skilled nursing homes are in Nome and Kotzebue. Previously, residents who needed nursing home care mostly relocated to the road system. Hodges leads me into a resident room.
Here's our typical private room. We have a bed and we have a dresser. Each room has a countertop with a sink. The other nice feature in all the rooms is we have an overhead lift. A lot of the elders aren't able to get themselves out of bed, or they need help getting into a chair, and this electric lift is so nice. It comes over, it comes down, and then it actually drives itself along the track, and the track goes all the way around into the bathroom.
The state's older population is expected to more than double in the next 20 years, from around 72,000 to more than 150,000 in 2030. Denise Daniello with the Alaska Commission on Aging says more facilities like the Elders Home in Bethel are needed. She cites data showing Alaska has the fastest growing senior population in the nation, and the fastest growing segment includes those 85 and older.
Currently, we have about 5,900 people age 85 and older that is projected to more than triple over the next 20 years to 18,800 people age 85 and older. And this population is the most vulnerable and also most at risk for developing chronic disease conditions as well as Alzheimer's disease and related dementia.
YKHC worked with Senator Lyman Hoffman and Representative Bob Herron to secure appropriations for the elders' home. Construction cost $16.3 million. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Finally tonight, a correction. In our story last night on an Aleutian kayaking adventure, we said Sarah Uten and her partner are attempting to kayak the entire Aleutian chain. In fact, their route is along the parts of the chain with a permanent population from Adak to Homer. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Matthew Smith and Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Daisha Eaton in Bethel. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, earning Alaska's trust for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. Salmonlove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.